Welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte, a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real-life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, check me out at ritaschulte.com. That's S-C-H-U-L-T-E.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. You can also find me on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC or follow me on Twitter at Heartline Pod. So let's get going on this journey of the heart. Kirsten Hagelin had the honor of serving as Miss America 2008. During that time, she served as Goodwill Ambassador for the Children's Miracle Network and was a tireless advocate for increased awareness of eating disorders as a public health priority. She's now the Community Relations Specialist for Timberline Knowles Residential Treatment Center. She's a NIDA Ambassador and a television personality, having appeared on Fox News, CNN, Fox Business Network, and HuffPost Live. In 2009, she founded the Kirsten Hagelin Foundation, whose mission is to fundraise to provide treatment scholarships to assist families and individuals battling eating disorders. I got to spend some time with Kirsten in Nashville earlier this year, and she's an all-around class act. I'm excited to have her here with us today. Here she comes, Miss America. Kirsten, welcome to Heartline.
Hi, thank you so much.
You've spoken around the world, and you've been really transparent about your struggles, and I love that about you. Can you talk a little bit about growing up and how you began your struggle with an eating disorder?
Sure. I started to struggle with an eating disorder, at least the behaviors, around age 12. But as anyone who has struggled with body image issues or any other disordered eating patterns, we know that the struggle really begins in the mind and often begins many years before we actually struggle with eating disorder behaviors. And that was really the case for me. I grew up in a very loving family, but I had an older brother who had some behavioral health issues. He was dyslexic and had a learning disability, and I was in ballet, and I was always the good kid. I got straight A's, you know, I wasn't the problem child, and kind of there was always this expectation for me to perform at a certain level that was placed on me by my teachers, ballet teachers and parents, but also by myself, because I always got positive reinforcement when I did well from other people. And so from an early age, I got validation from my performance, whether it was in school or at home or in the dance world. And I was pretty seriously considering a career in ballet from a young age. I was very talented and really enjoyed dance. And so got on that path pretty early. But at age 12, I went away to study for the summer for the first time at a very exclusive ballet school, and was away from my family for a whole summer. And of course, you're 12 years old, your body is changing.
Yeah.
And you become very self-aware and body conscious for the first time in my life, I did. And for the first time, just absolutely hated my body. And it was because I was growing. And as I grew, I was terrified that I would lose this very, you know, prepubescent, you know, no chest, no hips kind of body that is so ideal in ballet. I was so afraid that I would grow out of my dream, basically, that the shape of my body would keep me from being a professional ballet dancer. And that was my whole life. That was where I received validation, love, and everything. So that summer also, my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. And so just kind of my world really shifted from being this totally happy one where I was just kind of in control of everything and everything was great for me, to being one where I really didn't know what the next day was going to bring. And kind of out of stress and just this complete feeling of being out of control, I started to diet, thinking that if I just lost 5 pounds and I got on this track to, you know, getting the body that I wanted, that I'd be happy. And of course, we all know that whatever lie that we believe going into our eating disorder behaviors is always just that. It's a lie. It's not the truth. It's a deception that if you believe that, then you will become what you want to become in order to be satisfied. And I just really started to struggle with severe restriction and anorexia. In 3 years, it just got worse and worse and worse. As the eating disorder just took control and is completely enslaved to the mindset completely controlled by thoughts of food and weight and calories, and also just meeting up to everyone else's expectations. And this life that I built on performing for others in order to feel like I was worth something just spiraled out of control. And about 3 years later, when I was 15 years old, was when my parents got me help and realized something was seriously wrong and took me to a doctor. And from there, he set me up with a outpatient treatment team of doctors to in order to, you know, get better. And I started to try to recover. And for the first 6 months, I was in complete denial. I didn't want to get better at all. I thought the doctors were just trying to make me fat, and they were not. They really were trying to save my life. But really had a dark moment when I realized that this, you know, disease could really take my life. The consequences were much more serious than me just being depressed all the time, that it seriously could take my life. I could have a cardiac arrest at 16. And that terrified me and started to motivate me to work with my nutritionist and actually listen to what she was saying and follow my meal plan and work with my therapist. And so I did. And 2 years later, after a lot of really hard work, I mean, it was, you know, 2 years, and it was really, really difficult and painful. But I quit ballet. I decided that that wasn't the best career path for me anymore, that I couldn't be in that environment and be healthy anymore.
Wow.
And tried to find my identity outside of ballet and outside of my eating disorder, and was able to do that with help of my family and my friends and their support. And 2 years later, found myself at a healthy weight and approved by my doctors to go off to college. And in a good place mentally and emotionally, insofar as that I had my toolkit, so to speak. I had practiced how to handle stress, practiced how to cope with things in my life not going right, with people rejecting me, which is something that I never was able to deal with before, and kind of had the tools for when those situations arose or when I had triggers in my life that I knew how to deal with it, with them without returning to the eating disorder. So that's my long story in a short form.
Well, a couple things. Did anyone ever say anything to you about the weight, or was that all self-imposed? I mean, yeah, you were getting, you know, accolades for your performance, and so you're getting your needs for value and worth and adequacy and acceptance and all that stuff met through your performance, through the ballet. But were there other pressures? Did anyone say, like one of your teachers or something, something about your weight or having to stay thin, and that planted, you know, another seed for the lies to grow?
Yeah, nobody said specifically to me, Kirsten, you need to lose weight. However, there were comments that were made by many ballet teachers over the time that I danced of, put your stomach in, your stomach's hanging out over your skirt, or you don't want to work that way or else you're going to get big thighs, big elephant thighs. You know, I mean, people would say stuff like that to me in a dance class and other girls, not just me. And it, there was this, you know, there was a scale in the bathroom. I mean, you know, there's all these little things, little that are kind of like, you want to make sure you don't get, you know, you don't get too
fat. Yeah, so all these messages are coming at you, maybe not, you know, somebody saying, hey, you need to lose weight, but you're getting the message loud and clear that if I want to perform here, I've got to be skinny.
Then you have to, right, you have to look a certain way. It's very similar to the fashion community where models are just not hired if they're not a certain size for the runway, you know.
Exactly. Okay, so what broke through the denial? You said you were in denial for quite a while. What? That's a big piece for a lot of people. And as a therapist, I see that all the time. Oh, I don't really have a problem, or I can control it, or it's not that bad, or whatever.
Yeah, there are good days and bad days, I think, in your recovery when you think, I can really do this. I want to work toward recovery. Like, I need this. I want to do this. And then there are bad days where the eating disorder voice takes over and goes, I cannot believe you're letting them do this. I cannot believe you're surrendering control. Your life was fine before you tried to do recovery, because recovery is so hard. And so I had a lot of ups and downs, and but just continued to be really, really stubborn. And really the moment for me came when I was still exercising and my parents would try to get me to stop, and, you know, with really little to no success at all. And so I was on a treadmill and I was running and I almost fainted and I tripped on that treadmill because I was so exhausted, and you know, hopped off obviously and sat down immediately, and was trying to regain my composure because it just felt like I was going to pass out. And my heart was beating just so fast, and I literally felt so out of control of my actual body. Mm-hmm. And all my life I'd been dancing, so I was a very physical person, very in tune with what was going on in my body. And for the first time in my life, I felt so out of control of my physical processes and really realized that I could die. And it was that moment when I realized, I don't want to die. Like, I want to do things in my life. I want to help people. I want to do something in the world. Like, just all of these dreams just came up from inside of me. And I don't even know where they came from, to be honest. But it was just this desire to live free.
Yeah.
That really, that seed was born. And it's not like that day, all of a sudden I went in and I was like, I'm going to work every single day and I'm going to be perfect in recovery. Because, you know, perfect in recovery doesn't exist.
Right.
But it was from that day, that first small step was taken toward believing that life in recovery is going to be better than life in your eating disorder. And that is the faith that you have to do every day of therapy and every day in life, really, is that by making good decisions every single day, life is going to be better on that side than it is going to be by reverting to your eating disorder.
Is that what motivated you? I mean, would you have to pull that, you know, into the here and now to keep on course?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and that's what, you know, that's what taking a leap of faith really is. And I think that is one of the best metaphors when talking about recovery from anything, because you have to really leap off in faith. Because the reason people stay in their addiction or their eating disorder or whatever it may be is because it's giving them something.
Mm-hmm.
It's giving them something that they like and that they want. You know, even though it's horrible, even though it's destroying them, that thing that it's giving them is very, very powerful.
Right.
But it requires a leap of faith, because you can't see it when you're in the darkest point. And you may not be able to fully understand how free your life is going to be, but you know that it will be. And you have to leap off that cliff in faith that your life is going to be better on the other side. And that was what motivated me, because I would get glimpses of it. I would have days where I had energy again. Then I was following my meal plan. Like, I would have the energy, and I hadn't had energy in like 3.5 years. And that motivated me incredibly. I started to be more even tempered with my family and my friends. I started to enjoy other activities outside of dance. And so those little happy moments, I journaled a lot and would find those happy moments. And that's what continued to propel me to move forward, that life was going to be better on the other side.
Did you realize you were depressed, do you think?
No. Mm-mm. No, not until after I got to a place where I was mentally stable. Because when I was in the, you know, from 12 years old on, and it was just in a constant state of depression and didn't realize it, because you never got out of it. And then once you realize that, you don't have to be sad and worried and anxious all the time and have this gnawing ache of isolation and despair in your soul. When you realize that there's life outside of that, then you realize, oh my goodness, what was I living with for so many years?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, no, I didn't realize it at that time.
It becomes like walking around with a low grade fever and not realizing you're sick, because it's, you know,
absolutely,
it's your normal.
Absolutely.
What about eating disorders as an addiction? Do you see eating disorders as addictions, or do you have a different take on it?
Well, I'm not a clinician, so I don't want to get myself in trouble, because I know that a lot of, you know, many clinicians have a very,
sides, yeah,
you know, have an eating disorder is absolutely not an addiction, and others that say we need to treat eating disorders more like addiction. So, you know, I'm not going to, you know, put myself clinically on one side or the other, because obviously I haven't done the research, but to me, when I hear other people that have struggled with substance or chemical abuse or alcohol addiction, to me, the cycle of the way that you think and the reason why you go to that thing, to me, are very similar to an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the difference, the main difference between alcohol addiction and substance or chemical abuse and eating disorders is that an alcoholic can abstain from alcohol for the rest of his life. You know, someone who has been addicted to drugs can, you know, obviously can and should abstain from using that drug for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
However, with an eating disorder, you have to face that temptation multiple times a day, every single day. And so it's a constant discipline to moderate your thoughts and not let that addiction, so to speak, have control of your life. And that takes a lot of work. So, you know, you can't abstain from food like alcoholics or, those who have chemical or substance abuse can abstain from their drug. So, but it does take a similar mental discipline, and it does take a realization that going to that coping, you know, that coping mechanism, for lack of a better word, is not going to fulfill you. It's not going to give you happiness. It's not going to give you satisfaction. It's not going to give you a carefree life. It's not going to solve your problems. it's not going to help you from or keep you from dealing with your deep emotional issues. It's not going to do anything that it says it will. You know, the voice of the drug or the voice of the alcohol or the voice of the eating disorder. They're all lies and manipulators of our brain until we realize that and decide we want to be free of them.
Absolutely. That's so right on. It's a temporary fix. It might suffice for the moment, but in the long term, it's not going to last.
Absolutely.
So you had obsessive thoughts. What did you do? Mm-hmm. What did you learn therapeutically, you know, to pull out of the toolbox to help with that? Because that's a big part of what I see with my clients. And I know a lot of people listening probably have the same thing going.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I was very rigid in my life always and very tied to a schedule and very just completely rigid about anything and everything. And that was one of the first things that my therapist tried to work with me on. At first, I thought she was crazy because she was telling me to not do my homework on Friday night and to go out with my friends more. And some of these very, very little steps first to modify. And at first, I thought she was trying to make me a bad student.
And she was trying to teach me to be this
horrible person. But really, she was trying to instill in me that to moderate and balance from this, you know, attitude of rigidity. And that is something that I still have to work on and that I still work on in my everyday life, you know.
Is that something that's innate? Or is that something that, you know, you think you learned being in the family that you were born into?
I mean, I honestly think, I mean, my dad is a very type A kind of disciplined person, but he's, I mean, in a totally healthy way. I mean, mm-hmm. he uses it to his advantage, but he doesn't go crazy. So, you know, do I think that we inherit some of our personality traits from our parents? Yes. But also, I mean, it was totally conditioned by being in ballet from 3 years old. I mean, in ballet, it is, I mean, you never show your emotions. Early is on time is late, late is you're fired. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, there was no room for, you know, if you were, you know, breathing too loud, it was like, be quiet. What are you thinking? You know, like,
wow.
You know, I mean, it's such a completely rigid environment. And so growing up in that, obviously, that kind of breeds that into you because that's what's safe, you know. And I think that we all emotionally and in our lives desire to create an environment that's safe.
Absolutely.
And so for me, rigidity was safe. You know, if you're flexible and you need to be flexible and spontaneous, there's no safety in that. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how you're going to feel. You don't know any of those things. So that's what, you know, one of the things my therapist really worked on with me at the beginning. But also then to really, you know, my therapist really helped me with my thoughts and laid the foundation of, you know, work that I think continues on for the rest of your life. And that, you know, she's saying you are just on a groove right now. Your brain is playing on one record groove. And that's negative thoughts about yourself, negative thoughts about others, a lack of self-confidence and doubt about what you can do and your abilities. Like your brain is just on that record groove right now. That's its default setting. She said, we got to get your brain going on another song. Mm. And that was the first time when she explained it that way that I really realized, oh my gosh, yeah, that is my default setting, but I can change my default setting. Like it's not easy and it takes work and time. But I can change the default setting so that it's good thoughts, so that they are more positive and realistic thoughts. And so that was, you know, what we really worked on and taking every thought captive mm-hmm. and, you know, really thinking about what you're thinking about. And that is something that I think even people that don't struggle with, a behavioral health issue need to learn and think about.
Yeah, no, it's
actually
it's a topic for my a book I've got in the can called Think This, Not That. You know, it's absolutely, we've got to recognize those things. We've got to see what we're paying attention to. Otherwise, we can't affect any change. But I think
absolutely.
You said something important, like I can choose to switch gears. I can choose to switch channels. Choice is a really important part of it. It's hard. It's hard to make that choice in the moment. But do you think that, you know, just recovery in general has to start with a choice? Like, I'm ready to do this and I'm going to choose to do this. Because I see a lot of people, they're just not ready to go there yet.
Yeah, I do. I do completely agree with you. And I think that, unfortunately, I think that there is a lot of value in the statement that you kind of have to hit rock bottom before you can make that choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because, and whatever your rock bottom is, I mean, mm-hmm. everyone's rock bottom is something different, you know? But because you have to want it, you know, if for a recovery to work, you have to want to do it. You have to want to do the work. You have to want it. And, you have to have something very powerful that keeps you motivated throughout the course of your recovery. And I do really, truly believe that you have to make the choice to want to get better. Because if you don't, you'll keep going back to, because the eating disorder is so strong.
Yeah.
And the voice of the eating disorder is so strong. But I think that's really empowering. And I think a lot of, you know, women especially that struggle with eating disorders can be very disempowered. I'm not sure if that's the, you know, exactly correct word, but by feeling like they don't have a choice and feeling like, well, maybe if they do enough therapy that one day they'll magically wake up and have a good body image, you know, like that just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't just magically happen. Like one day you go into enough therapy sessions and then you wake up and you're like, I feel good about my body. I don't need a restrict or I don't need to binge and purge. Like that just doesn't happen. It takes multiple times of the thought arising in your brain to not, you know, eat a meal or to, you know, binge and purge and act out, that thought coming up and you saying, I want to do that so badly, but I am not going to do that because I can choose not to do that. And right in this moment, I don't really feel strong, but I'm going to say no.
Yeah.
And it's many times of doing that in a row that then one day you wake up and you realize I haven't done that, you know, behavior in 30 days. Oh my gosh. You know, but you have to practice making the right choices every single day in your recovery. And yeah, you might flip up and you might have a couple bad days, but you get back on the horse. You know, you don't let a bad day or a couple bad days or even a bad week slow your stride moving forward. And I think that's what people think, they have to be perfect in recovery. But as long as you take the small steps and make the small good choices, you know, you're going to be on the path to getting there. But it doesn't magically happen. You definitely have to choose.
Yeah, you have to be intentional and deliberate about it is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah.
The other thing is you got to count the small victories. And just because you take a step backwards, like a lot of times with my, you know, bingers and purgers, the bulimics, you know, I'm like, man, if you, you know, start eating some cookies and you eat 5 or 6 cookies anywhere in that cycle of a binge, you can choose to say, I'm not going to do this anymore. So instead of eating the whole bag, you ate maybe 10 cookies. That's a victory because you have
Absolutely.
A choice no matter what or where you're in this cycle to say, I'm done. I'm going to move forward. And look at that as a victory,
Absolutely.
Not as a failure.
Absolutely. And yeah, and it's, and again, just like you said, look at it as a victory. That's a choice you make to look at that as a victory.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, if, the best thing in the world that you can do is if you're thinking negative thoughts, stop thinking about them and think something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, if you start thinking that it's a failure, say, no, I'm going to decide to think that that's a victory, even if I don't feel like it's a victory right now.
Yeah.
And if you change your thoughts, then your feelings start to change.
Well, that's exactly where I want to go. Like you, people will say, well, I can't tell myself that. I don't believe it. I can't, you know, say that because it's not true. I am fat or whatever. Like, how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, I have a lot of compassion for that because, you know, I absolutely love and adore my mother, and she's Italian, and she's a very emotional, passionate Italian woman.
That's
know?
Me.
I mean, her, you know, and she's very emotional. And so I grew up, you know, I'm emotional, but not quite as emotional as her. I have, you know, more of my dad's like stoic Swedish thing going on.
Uh-huh.
But I did inherit some of that from her. And so, you know, her emotions were always kind of very up and very down. And that's just, you know, the kind of person that she is, but she has gotten, you know, much better over the years and, you know, growing up. And I've really seen her grow as a person as she's, you know, regulated her emotions a little bit and really gotten strong and saying, just because I feel that doesn't mean I have to act in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really, you know, seen her grow and blossom in that way as I have tried to do, because I think I learned that if I feel this way, this is just what I'm going to do. And I just have to be in this feeling until my feeling or mood changes. And I, in the recovery of my eating disorder, really had to learn that, you know, and this might sound strange, but sometimes you just have to fake it till you make it.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you don't feel in that moment very powerful, or you don't feel in that moment very smart, or feel very confident, or feel any of those things, you put a smile on your face and you put your shoulders back and you create a different body language and you move forward, you know? And after, you know, doing that a lot of times, then all of a sudden you realize, oh, I actually feel more confident.
Yeah.
You know, it really is incredible how much you can change your feelings with the power of your thoughts. But again, I don't want to make it, you know, sound, oh, it's so easy. Like, it's really hard. I mean, this is the hardest thing of life, honestly.
Yeah.
That's why so many people that do recover from eating disorders, you know, I learn so much from the stories of recovered people that I hear, because, you know, you really, this forces you to work on the most difficult things in life. But even if people don't have a behavioral health issue, you know, they still might be enslaved to bad thinking, you know, because it doesn't manifest itself in an eating disorder. They're working on it too, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think where folks get in trouble, and we all do this, is we make our feelings into facts. So the fact that I feel fat means that I am fat. The fact that I feel worthless or unlovable means that I am worthless and unlovable. And we really have to learn that distinction, because one's speaking to our identity, you know, the other is speaking to a feeling, and feelings aren't necessarily bearers of truth. They're just instantaneous, you know, internal responses to the external events in our lives.
So, you know,
understanding that is really, really important. Let's back up for a minute. You, you talked a little bit about, you know, being really keyed in as a kid to rejection. Like, you liked the accolades and you liked when people liked you. Maybe you needed people to like you. Would you have said you were a people pleaser? I mean, is that accurate?
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. I was a people pleaser. I mean, I literally would do things to hurt and inconvenience myself in unbelievable ways to please my friends, teachers, people that I worked with, my parents.
What was the belief behind that, do you think? If I don't please people, if I don't please people, what's going to happen?
I think loneliness. I think from a very early age, and I don't know why, but I always really feared loneliness, being alone. So I was always like separated from my peers in some weird way. And I think from that early separation, you know, people saw me as different. And so because of that, I always felt a little bit ostracized and therefore isolated and alone. And I didn't want to be alone. I wanted people to love me. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be friends with others. I wanted to seek other people out. So, you know, I think that from a very, very early age, that was one of the reasons that I was afraid to be alone and wanted so much to please others.
Yeah. Well, Kirsten, we're out of time for today. Thank you for your willingness to come back next week and pick up and talk a little bit about the pageant and how that affected you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay.
I had a big hole in my heart, and I was looking.
Thanks for joining me today. If you have a question or comment, or you'd like to be a guest on Heartline, I'd love to hear from you. You can contact me at ritaschulte.com, on Facebook at Rita Schulte LPC, or Twitter at Heartline Pod. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.